At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.
Welcome to Talk Farm to Me, the podcast that brings you closer to the power of your choices, one farmer at a time. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and I have been here meeting with farmers across the United States since 2019, weaving their stories into a 35,000-foot view of a very important slice of our nation's history, health, environment, economy, and a renewed element of our zeitgeist. The more you listen, the more you will care. Not only where your food comes from, but also with who is producing it. You will see the dots connect from a small farm to your health, to the strength of your local community, to the health of the planet. The more you learn here, the more powerful you become. And sometimes that power is right under your nose and you just don't see it. Sometimes that power is as small as a seed in the hand of a small child. You'll see. Stay with me till the end for some goosebump-inducing advice from today's guest. Let's go to Westport, Connecticut, to the greenhouse of farmer Sal Gilberti, where he presides over a plethora of organic herbs that you can plant in your garden. You will love how he got the idea of going organic on the heels of meeting some high society ladies. Before I open the doors to the greenhouse, I want you to imagine the heat and humidity in there, the smell of the soil mixed with thyme and basil. It also has its own sound, an echoing of that growth and the heartbeat of the person who has tended this farm for many, many decades.
I'm a third generation farmer or grower. I was not expected to be because my dad sent me off to college to be an accountant. But then he got sick and passed away suddenly. And so being the oldest, I had to basically take over the business. Now, my grandfather started the business way back in 1922 as a cut flower grower. He migrated to this country in 1901. And migrated directly to Westport, Connecticut, because there was a large cut flower grower there, greenhouses, of course, that shipped into the New York market. Bear in mind that there was no such thing as air freight in those days. And so for the city of New York, they wanted flowers in the wintertime. They had to get them from within a 50-mile radius. So there were a lot of greenhouses, believe it or not, in the early 20th century that were built in Connecticut, basically Western Connecticut, and they all shipped into the New York market. And there were rose growers, there were gardenia growers, there were orchid growers. My grandfather worked for a company called the Philo Flower Company, and they grew basically roses, carnations, chrysanthemums, snapdragons, stuff like that. Then after working for them for 20 years, in 1919, he bought a piece of property in Westport also and began to build used greenhouses, and then he went into the cut flower business, and he was smart enough to not grow what Philo was growing. So he was growing things like ranunculus and anemones, freesias, dianthus, beeches, things of that sort. And then he got involved with a Dutchman named Doornbos, who taught him how to treat cool tulips, daffodils, and iris.
Pre-cooling bulbs means chilling them. In a controlled, cold environment, this mimics winter conditions and helps the bulbs wake up and produce flowers when planted. It's crucial in places where winters aren't cold enough. The bulbs need pre-cooling for 6 to 12 weeks at temperatures between 34 and 45 degrees Fahrenheit. This process, done in a cooler, not a freezer, ensures a beautiful and even bloom, providing them with the best conditions to thrive.
And so and that would force them earlier on this pre-cooling process. So he was able to ship daffodils, tulips, and iris into the New York market in January, and nobody had them. So he made a lot of money. He bought another Ranger greenhouse in Norwalk, and he was basically in the cut bar business.
So the marketplace that they lived in, that's very different than the marketplace today.
Oh, indeed, because once air freight came in after World War II, they were all out. They were out of business. So they either diversified or they closed up, and many of them closed up. But our family chose to diversify into potted plants. They knew they weren't shipping potted plants by air. So they started growing, obviously, the holiday plants like the poinsettias and cyclamen and calentos for Christmas, and then the calceolarias and cineraras, and then all of the other bulb flowers, azaleas, and so forth beyond that. And then they went into ornamentals, you know, like geraniums and petunias and daisies and so forth. So they diversified. They had a lot of greenhouse space, and they were desperately looking for crops to fill them up, because the cut flower business had pretty much gone away. And there was, we were lucky because we lived in Fairfield County in Connecticut, which is a very wealthy area. There were a lot of wealthy people there. And there was an estate there, the von Langendorf estate, that had about 18 acres. And they had 6 or 7 full-time gardeners. And she wanted an herb garden. She wanted a formal herb garden. And so they came to my dad and asked him if he would grow basic herbs, you know, sage, oregano, tarragon, so forth. And they had a 60-foot in diameter, large circular pie-shaped garden with 12 slices of the pie, little walkways in between each slice. And each of those slices could accommodate 60 plants. So they ordered 60 plants of each of these 12 varieties of herbs. And my dad, being a conservative grower, he put in 100 plants of each. This was in 1958. And so when he made his delivery in May, he had these left over, and we had a little garden center there at the same time. So we put them out, and they sold. And I was fresh out, almost getting out of school, and he said, quick, learn about herbs. And so I took it on as my baby to do it. And then he passed away suddenly. And so then I had to sort of make it happen. But I was very, very lucky, blessed, I should say, that in the neighboring town of Western Connecticut lived a woman named Edna Cashmore, Mrs. Percy Cashmore. And she had the prestigious distinction of being the president of the Herb Society of America.
The Herb Society of America started in 1933 in the parlor of one of 7 women friends in Massachusetts who were interested in exploring the study and research of herbs, a not yet emerging field. Edna Cashmore was honored by the Society in 1968 for her outstanding contributions to the Herb Society of America and to the world of horticulture in general.
And she sort of took me under her wing. And she said, Sal, these are what I think you can raise for next year. So I learned an awful lot about networking. I learned a lot about identification, because you'd send away for a particular plant and then it would come in and it was different from plant that you thought you had, or it was the same as something that was different. She said, don't worry about it. Mrs. So-and-so from Chicago, she did her thesis at Cornell on thyme plants, and when she comes, she can identify them. And that's the way it happened when she came. It was on our board of directors. The board of directors met every June at her house from all over the country that came in. And so, as I said, I was so blessed to be involved when no one was growing herbs. I mean, we were the only game in town. And if you were growing herbs in the 50s, you were either a witch or a warlock. Nobody believed what you were doing. So we were very, very fortunate, and we kept growing more and more herbs. And we were fortunate because we were in Fairfield County. And there was a lot of money here, and a lot of people were traveling now after the war was over. And they were traveling into Europe. They saw herb gardens in Europe, and they began to buy from us. And so we got bigger and bigger. And then after the ecology boom started in the 60s, people began to recognize salt-free diets and things of that sort.
In the 1960s, people started caring a lot more about the environment. This ecology boom happened because of things like Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which talked about how pesticides were harming nature. Events leading up to Earth Day in 1970 also got people thinking about environmental issues. During this time, important laws were passed to protect the environment, and groups like the Sierra Club gained popularity, making the 60s a key period in the rise of the modern environmental movement.
I'm sorry, what kind of diets?
Salt-free diet, and using herbs as flavoring. And so that began to grow. And also, I think what was happening at the same time, because of the ecology boom, people were beginning to look at more natural things.
Mind if I make a comment before we move to this new decade? You've got this family that has this history in flowers and plants, and you kind of get dealt a little bit of good luck and a little bit of bad luck all at the same time. Your father passes away unexpectedly. You're going to be an accountant. And then lo and behold, there's this sort of the queen of herbs is right there in your backyard. It makes me think really about all of the farmers that I talk to and all the farmers that I know and just how difficult it can be sometimes. You know, there are personal things happen and business shifts, like you said, transportation after the war and all of that. And luck just kind of factors in such a crazy way.
There's no question about that. There's no question about it. But I like to think of it as a blessing. It's just the different things that happened to me in the course of my life. Like, wow, why did that happen? And at the same time, as you said, farming is not easy. It's not an easy business. It's 24/7. You can't blink. And you have to fall in love with it. Because if you're not in love with it, you're not going to stay with it. And there's no question about that. You have to love what you're doing. And once you fall in love with the soil, I think that then it just grows on you. My dad, being a cut flower grower, they used a lot of chemicals. I mean, they sprayed for everything. And they used to spray and be smoking at the same time and sometimes eating sandwiches at the same time. You know, it's a craziness. We started growing the herbs and these ladies started coming and sampling the herbs. And I said, wait a minute, I can't use this crap on them. And so I started to look into all natural ways of growing without using any chemical. And I was like the first one on the East Coast that brought in beneficial insects.
Good bugs, like ladybugs and bees and many others you probably aren't familiar with, are beneficial insects. They help out by eating pests, pollinating plants, and breaking down dead stuff. These bugs are like nature's pest control and play a vital role in keeping things balanced in gardens and ecosystems. It's a good idea to welcome them and to avoid using harmful chemicals.
I got involved with a guy from Colorado by the name of Richard Gerhardt. He was a Dutchman, and he was bringing in, the Dutch are way ahead of us in growing, they still are. And he started bringing in beneficials from Holland. And I started buying the beneficials from him. And I remember him telling me this. I always remember. He said, Sal, remember, the beneficials will keep your house clean, but they won't clean your house. I always remember that. So he said, in other words, you can't start off with an infestation and expect to bring in some beneficial insects, and all of a sudden you're going to be fouled. And so you have to keep it clean. And that was another thing that, well, our family was pretty fanatical about keeping in greenhouses. And that's really important. I mean, you keep the weeds out, because once you get some weeds in competition with the plants, then you start to get problems with the plants, and then you start to bring in that insect started coming in, and diseases start to come in. So the cleaner you keep your farm, your greenhouses, the better off you're going to be from day one. And so I learned a lot about that and bringing in beneficials. And I remember the biggest problem we had was an insect called white fly. I don't know if you ever heard of white flies. But the white flies are a very big pest in the greenhouses, especially on things like London verbena and geraniums and things of that sort. And so he told me about an insect wasp called Encarthia formosa. And we bought in Encarthia formosa, and all of a sudden we didn't have any white fly anymore. It was wonderful because it would attack the mints and the eggs. and so they did a job. I never became an entomologist, but I learned a lot about entomology when I was studying all the insects. And a white fly, a female white fly, lays 800 eggs. That's a lot of kids.
Yeah, that's a lot to combat.
But the life cycle is very short. It's only like 12 days. But you have to get at them to keep it going. Many insects are like that. We still battle that. I mean, we still are bringing in all kinds of, there's all kinds of new insects. But it's wonderful because to look at what our good Lord sent us with the bad guys and the good guys, you know. It's a fun thing to do. Entomology is is a lot of fun.
Let me ask you this, because you brought up two things that I'm interested in asking you about. One is that you said that if you are going to be a farmer, you better be in love with it. And I'm wondering, you had this other path, and I can tell you're in love with it still after all these years. I can feel your energy and your enthusiasm. So I'm just curious what first made you fall in love with being a farmer?
The soil, no question about the soil, and the seeds. Because when you're planting seeds and you see the miracle of the growth, it's so invigorating. You can't not fall in love with it. You know, it's wonderful to see that. These little seeds that, wow, look what happens here. And if you take care of them properly, they give you terrific rewards. And you're always going to have the battle of the weather. You're always going to have the battle of insects and of diseases, of fungus and things like that. That battle is always going to go on, but there are successes. And the successes are far greater than the failures. And also bear in mind that farmer has to pay attention. So you have to pay attention all the time. It isn't a workplace where you can, you know, put it away for the weekends. And I mean, you can still have a lot of fun. You can still have another life, but at the same time, you have to pay attention all the time. And that, to me, that makes it so exciting and so invigorating compared to sitting at a desk counting numbers.
I agree with you. I don't want to sit at a desk unless I get a chance to talk to people like you. So something else that you mentioned was about the entomology. And I feel your fascination there. And certainly you've learned a ton about insects since you brought over your first bugs that enabled you not to have to use pesticides. I'm interested to hear what you think about this, but I feel like every farmer is a lot more than a grower, or they're a lot more than a rancher. You know, they have to be mechanics and veterinarians and to fix things. And like you said, to observe things and to know a lot about the plants and the soil and the bugs. How do you do all of that?
I think it comes to you naturally. And you also, there's a lot of places to learn from. You know, you learn from other growers. I learned a lot from other growers that were very generous with their knowledge. I also was very lucky because my dad was partners with his two brothers. And one of them, Uncle Ed, he took me under his wing and he taught me an awful lot about growing and what to watch for, watering in particular. Don't go watering at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or invite people. And the sprinklers on the garden at night, it's crazy. It's the worst thing you could do because it gets the plants wet. The plants are wet and fungus can grow. So you water it really early in the morning. And it was little things like that that I was taught. And you see the difference between the successes and failures when you're paying attention. That's the other thing that I love about organic. You really have to pay attention with organic, you know, because you have to be ahead of the curve. You don't play catch up. You can't play catch up with organic. You've got to be ahead of it. So you got to bring in beneficials before you have an infestation. Or you have to watch your watering so that you don't get fungus building up. You have to watch, make sure you're getting enough space, enough light, enough air circulation. Those things are really important. People are planting their gardens in crazy places. They just don't know any better. People don't know enough about gardening, and sometimes they get the wrong information. It's so easy to recognize the fact that the sun has to have a big play in this, and the watering has to be careful, and the air and light circulation are so important. And those are things that you learn, and it just comes to you natural after a while.
Now, you were saying earlier that soil was very exciting to you. And as information comes out in these movements around farming, there's a little bit more noise about soil. And I'm concerned that the regular consumers aren't really understanding why soil is as important as it is.
Well, there's a lot of negative things going on with because of the hydroponic. And hydroponic growers want to say we're saving water, and farming is bad. I mean, soil is bad. They're using too much fertilizer. They're doing everything wrong with the soil. So the way to go is hydroponic.
Hydroponics is a way of growing plants without using soil. Instead, plants get their nutrients from a water solution that contains all of the necessary minerals. There's no dirt involved, just a support system like coconut coir, a natural fiber from the husk of coconuts, or rock wool, a growing medium made from molten basalt rock. Plants in hydroponic setups are used in limited areas as a space saver. Hydroponic systems can have environmental impact such as dependency on non-renewable resources for system components, high energy consumption, and nutrient waste management.
And they lobby for this. They lobby for and watch. They have to put a spin on it that soil is bad and water is the way to go.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, a lot of them are already falling on their face because of the fact that they've raised a lot of money. And basically, the money that they raise is from Silicon Valley for technology, because from the seeds to the package is never touched by human hand. It's all a machine with the lights and so forth.
In 2022, indoor farming like this made up around 20% of the total that Silicon Valley venture capital plowed into ag tech startups. There are limitations. Not every crop can be grown hydroponically or vertically. As early as late 2022, the honeymoon period started to wane. Vertical farms were relying on more and more investments with expenses, like infrastructure and high salaries for software engineers, as an example, outweighing the profits by 4-1 or worse.
But the thing is, they have to cheat. They have to put the chemicals in the soil somehow. They have to put the nutrients that are needed. So they have to control the fungus. There's a lot of water there, and fungus is going to grow with the moisture that's there. So they have to control that. So there's things that they have to do, and you certainly are never going to get the flavor out of water, even the chemicals that they're adding, the nutrients that they're adding. You're never going to get the flavor, and you're never going to get the taste, and you're never going to get the nutrients. You're not going to get the nutrients of the soil. I mean, that's where it comes from. But that's a hard argument today, because they've had so much spin on their method of growing. And they've raised a lot of money. There's a microgreen company called Aero Farm. They raised, I don't know, something like $300 million to build all these. And the first year, they lost $69 million. Well, you can't stay in business that way, you know? And I think that the investors are beginning to recognize this. It's almost like a Ponzi scheme. They're recognizing that they're not getting their investments back. And so they've got a long way to go to prove their point. The point is that has to be proven to them is soil-grown product on farm. In 1969, the Great Danbury Fair in Danbury, Connecticut, celebrated its 100th anniversary. At that time, we were growing, we had about 70 varieties, 75 varieties of herbs. And I said, well, we could say we had 69 varieties, you know, and we'll go to the Danbury Fair, because simultaneously the rock group, Simon and Garfunkel, came out with a song called Scarborough Fair. I don't know if you ever heard it. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. So I saw dollar signs, because I figured if I grew a parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme and brought them up to the Great Danbury Fair, I would make a fortune. I went to see Mr. Leahy, who was the president of the Great Danbury Fair, and he said, Sal, the older gentleman, he was younger than I am now, but he said, Sal, this year, 700,000 people are going to come to my fair. Well, then it's a 10-day fair. I saw dollar signs. If I figured I could sell one herb to every 10th person that walks through. You know? So I grew 70,000 pots of parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And we took out a big, big booth in the middle of the fair. In fact, it could only hold 3,500 plants in a booth. So I hired some firemen and, you know, retirees and renting some trucks, and then we're going to, you know, bring in the plants and take back the money. It was a great plan. There were 710,000 people came to the Great January Fair in perfect weather every day. The Budweiser booth sold about 10 million bottles of beer. And of the 710,000 people, only 412 saw fit to buy a plant.
412 people?
Yes, 412 plants. That's all I sold in 10 days.
I'm going to go see one now. I was sure. That's the most brilliant idea I've ever heard, the parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
It didn't work. But I want to tell you what happened from that, because as Martha Stewart would say, it was a good thing. And it was a good thing, because what happened was that, you know, when you're stuck with 70,000 or something, you got to learn marketing pretty fast. So I took my van and went from New Haven down to Port Chester, New York on US 1. And I stopped at every garden center or florist shop and with parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And he all said the same thing. You can have those blankety blank things. They're nothing but trouble. Ladies come in, they want to ask them all kinds of questions, you know, how to use them, how to plant them. And I recognized at that point that there was not enough information. There wasn't enough information. So I developed a label which had the common name, the botanical name, the duration, sun, shade, spacing, height, and then some general uses. And that label took off. I recognized at that point that there wasn't enough information. But you can have those blankety-blank things. They're nothing but trouble. So that was in 1969. Then it grew from there. And, you know, in 2000 and 2001, we sold 2.2 million pots of herbs.
From 412 plants at that fair with 710,000 people, by any measurement, a huge failure, to 2.2 million pots of herbs in 1 year, Sal has been around talking with garden clubs and publishing multiple books on herbs and gardening. I'll give you a link in the show notes. One thing's for sure, he doesn't give up.
I'm curious, you know, like the intersection between farmers and sometimes I think farmers struggle to really get to know their customers. I have a feeling you know yours really well, and I want to hear what they're like.
I think that the retail customers, as I said, you know, we're in a wonderful area of the country where people, I think, have a lot more exposure to information, to travel, and just to their own education. And I think that they recognize the goodness of organics. I don't think 10 years ago I could have said that. When we went to school, everybody, I mean everybody, the whole school had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Everybody had peanut butter and jelly. Nobody was allergic. Kids are not allergic to the peanuts. They're allergic to the chemicals. They're using kind of peanuts. That's the problem. I think people are beginning to recognize that. Why are there so many kids that are having problems of all sorts? There's too many chemicals in all that we're consuming. We're consuming this stuff, you know. And now you would think about going out and drinking some terrible chemical. I mean, people are very careful about what they're putting into their mouth, but they're not careful about what they're putting in their mouths with the food. And that's the big thing. That's the biggest single thing. Look, peanuts are rhizomes. So you pick up everything that's in the soil.
Rhizomes are subterranean shoots that grow horizontally. The major function of rhizomes are food storage and vegetative reproduction for the plants. Peanuts, which are legumes and not nuts, grow underground where they are in contact with any and all soil inputs.
How do they grow peanuts? They hit the fields first with an herbicide. Now they have what they call selective herbicides. Isn't this wonderful? It kills everything but peanuts. Isn't that great? It's craziness. They did it with a fungicide. They did it with liquid nitrogen. They do all this stuff, and all of that gets sucked up by those peanuts. And all of a sudden, we got allergies all over the place. You know, I talked to a guy who told me that he was in the field of snack foods. And he said, the United States is the only country in the world where there's nut allergies. And I think people are recognizing that more and more, at least in our area. I think people who have the education and have the knowledge of what's going on they're recognizing that, and they recognize how important it is, especially root crops. Oh my God, you should never be buying anything that is not organic, in potatoes, onions, garlic, carrots, any of that stuff. That should be grown organically. And if it isn't organically, then you should grow yourself. You shouldn't eat that kind of stuff. You shouldn't, because it builds up in your system and nobody can figure it out. Come on, why can't they figure it out? When you see a Roundup ad on TV that tells you how wonderful it is that you're not going to get any weeds in your driveway for a minimum of 6 months, and yet there's no warning at all that says, yes, Roundup causes cancer. They know it causes cancer. Why is it on the label? Why don't they tell you that? I think the new farmers that are coming along, they're all trying to be organic. Organic is harder because you got to pay more attention. There's no question about it. There's no quick fixes. You got to work at it. But if you pay attention, you don't have as many problems. You're always going to have some problems, but you don't have as many. But I think that the other thing is that I like what I've seen in the last few years around here, and I'm sure it's going on throughout the whole country, is a number of farmers' markets that are out there. Because this gives the farmer an opportunity to make some more money, to be able to support himself. If he's losing money selling wholesale, he's paying somebody $2 a bushel to pick it, and then he only gets $2.50 for the bushel. Doesn't work. But if he can sell it at a farmer's market at a retail price, and if he can show that he's organic and get a higher price, then he can do much better for himself. And if he can do much better for himself, then he has the financial rewards that help him to keep going. Because if he's being busted all the time, he has no money, then eventually he's going to give up. And so I'm so pleased with the amount of farmers markets that are out there. And I hear once in a while, oh my God, you go to farmers market, it's so expensive. But yeah, but you're supporting this farmer. And I think that a lot of people who are shopping at farmers markets appreciate that, and they're willing to pay that extra price. And with that extra price at retail, that farmer is going to survive and keep going.
This is an issue I keep hearing about. The farmers market is expensive. And I don't think that we can get by answering that with, you're supporting a farmer response. What I want you to think about when you hear that is this. Something is wrong with the system. If a farmer can't make a living wage selling wholesale, isn't that a problem? If the only way to stay afloat is to produce more and more and get bigger and bigger, where quantity helps a farmer stay on top of loans to the bank, but doesn't end up feeding their business, don't we have a problem? Well, we'll talk about it, but I just wanted to plant that seed here.
What I'm curious to hear about from you is what you want the 98% who are not farmers to understand about our farmers.
I think the most important thing is to teach the kids to grow.
Teach the kids to grow. Isn't that an amazing piece of advice? Here's a little story about a boy and his mom that really put this idea in Sal's head.
I said, Mom, come here. I got to show you. And he pulled up a carrot. And she said, she had to be 40, 45 years old. He said, oh my God, that's where carrots come from? I started crying. I said, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. A woman that age and she didn't know where carrots come from. I guess she thought they only come on a shelf in a Stop and Shop or something. But the point is, her kid knew. She didn't. All the kids have to learn how to grow. To me, that's the most important thing. Teach the kids. Teach the kids how to grow. Teach the kids the importance of the food and the food chain and where it's coming from.
Sal Gilberti was going to be an accountant. When his father died, the business was in transition. He found an unsuspecting mentor in a sideline garden club. Herbs were lower down the status ladder than flowers, for example. He kept going. In 1969, he had an epic public failure, and he was undeterred. Pivot, observe, talk to people, connect, learn from your mistakes. Sal is the epitome of the kind of people who are farming quietly in greenhouses, fields, urban centers, and on ranches in faraway valleys. He's an example of the kind of person you need to know, where your input is important as a customer, where your efforts are rewarded with an herb garden, with new knowledge to make that garden thrive and to extend from that personal experience, or the experience of that boy sharing the joy of pulling a carrot from the ground, to a greater understanding of our food, the systems we have in place, and the ones that could be. Thank you for joining Sal and me here today in the greenhouse with hopeful herbs all around for another episode of Talk Farm to Me, the podcast that brings you closer to the power of your choices, one farmer at a time. I am delighted that you are a part of all of these stories, and to encourage more of them for more listeners, I hope you will do me a huge favor. Go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and a review with what you love about it. Your support means the world to me and to all of the farmers whose stories are featured here. I will leave you a link in the show notes. Thank you. And thank you to the Talk Farm to Me team, Sonia Dillon for co-production and Russell Chapa for sound design and original music. I look forward to being with you again for the next episode, maybe at a farm near you.
At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America, NMLS 407249, Equal Housing Lender, loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.